On the campaign trail, there's been lots of talk about ways to help the 39 million Americans living in poverty. Democratic candidates Cory Booker and Bernie Sanders have both recently rolled out poverty policy plans, specifically ways to help the children of those families most impacted.
It is not moral, it is not acceptable, and it is not sustainable that the top one-tenth of 1% now owns almost as much wealth as the bottom 90%.
I live in a low-income black and brown community. I see every single day that this economy is not working for average Americans.
Cory Booker speaking there, and before him, Bernie Sanders. We wanted to take a closer look at what child poverty looks like in America right now and why there hasn't been much change in the number of kids living below the poverty line since 1969, according to Pew Research. Nisha Patel is managing director of Narrative Change and National Initiatives for Robinhood, a New York City-based nonprofit focused on fighting poverty, and she joins us now from New York. Hi, Nisha.
Thank you, Tanya. Thanks for having me.
So when you were with the U.S. Partnership on Mobility from Poverty, you and your team took on this really big question. What would it take to dramatically increase mobility from poverty? And so you guys went to 30 communities, places like New York City, the Mississippi Delta, Silicon Valley, Detroit, and you found that where a child grows up really impacts mobility. Tell us more.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, one of our U.S. partnership members put it best when he said, today, when it comes to poverty in the United States, zip code matters more than genetic code. So where we are born and where we grow up can have a huge impact on future outcomes. For children who are born into poverty, so the bottom 20% of income, based on where they were born, but when they got to be adults, what were their chances of moving out and up to the top? And if you can imagine a map of the United States, you see vast differences. For a child, for example, born in the Mississippi Delta into poverty versus a child, as you mentioned, born in Silicon Valley, right, in the San Jose area. And so even in places where you see significant job growth, that doesn't necessarily automatically mean that there are great opportunities for everyone or that opportunity is equally distributed in those communities.
Yeah, so it's really not surprising that you also found that gender, race, and immigration status also matters. In what ways?
You know, we looked very specifically, and you could look at it in a number of ways. We looked specifically at wages. And sometimes there are these, you know, inaccurate notions that if people are living in poverty, it's because somehow they're not working. And what we found is that, in fact, is not the case. And so we looked at data around who is working in low-wage jobs, and we used $12.50 an hour or less. And what we found first when we looked at gender was that when we look at white men, only about 20% of white men are working in low-wage jobs, and that number is much greater for women. And then we said, well, what if we then – it's important to look at the intersection of issues. So what if we crossed gender with race? So I just mentioned white men. So we have far more, for example, black women. So what, 20% of white men are working in low-wage jobs. Double that number, 40% of black women are working in low-wage jobs, and then 46% of Latino or Hispanic women. And then we said, okay, it's really important to look at immigration status as well. More than 60% of Hispanic women who are non-citizens, and that includes women who are legal permanent residents, 60% are working in low-wage jobs, right? So that's triple the percentage of white men.
Were there any surprises when you went into those communities, maybe things you didn't expect to learn?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was one of the most powerful things that we did. And I felt so strongly about it because I've had the good fortune to sit in a lot of privileged positions in government and philanthropy. And one of the things I have realized and have tried, really spent my career trying to combat, is this idea that, you know, people who are closest to the challenge, people living in poverty themselves, are rarely at those tables when decisions are made. And it's one of the reasons I felt so strongly we had to spend time in communities actually breaking bread, speaking with people who are experiencing poverty. And you learn from that things that you maybe just, even with the best data and research, don't come through. So, for example, you mentioned we went to Silicon Valley, and we went there because it is one of the communities historically for children who are born into poverty where they have the best fighting chance of getting out. So we wanted to say, well, what's going on there? What's the context? And is that still true today? It's true historically, but is it true today? And so we were having a conversation, breaking bread, having lunch with some parents, primarily women, in the Mayfair community in East San Jose. This is the neighborhood where Dolores Huerta and Cesar Chavez began their organizing. We kept talking about over lunch this idea of being in Silicon Valley, and we're having this conversation in simultaneous Spanish-English interpretation so that everyone could participate in their own language and their own voice. And one of the women stopped us, and she said in Spanish, "What is this word you keep using? What is Silicon Valley?"
Oh, wow. And she lived right in the heart of Silicon Valley.
She lived in the heart of Silicon Valley, and you could hear a pin drop, because I think it struck many of the folks in our group, particularly the academic scholars, how sort of, I think, illustrative that is of both the cultural and economic divide that exists, right? These are families living within 30 minutes of the largest tech companies on the planet, yet never the twain shall meet.
There's this new report that discovered many families lose their Medicaid health care because of these confusing rules and procedures that they have to go through to seek care. I know that you all focused very much at looking at the reasons that folks are in poverty, but I can imagine this type of challenge kind of has a cascading impact for families who are just scraping to get by.
I think that's absolutely right. So, you know, healthcare is just one aspect, but if you think about a family or a household budget, right, healthcare is one of the high costs. Childcare is another high cost. Housing is another high cost. And so thinking about how does a family that's struggling make those choices? Do I pay for medicine? Do I pay for the doctor? Do I pay for food? What can give? And, you know, honestly, those are all basic needs. I don't think any of them can give.
I'm just thinking about how systemic this is, how over time we've seen this generation after generation. President Lyndon B. Johnson famously declared the war on poverty back in the 60s. And during that time, that declaration really unleashed this funding to spur economic growth for poorer communities. But all these years later, we're seeing these same statistics, these numbers, these disparities. Based on your research, what are you finding where we're seeing the need for perhaps government intervention, maybe in the way that we saw during Lyndon Johnson's time?
One of the reasons we need government intervention is when there are market failures, right? And so when we have people working very hard and not making the kind of wages that can support a family. You know, for example, we looked at data from the National Low-Income Housing Coalition that found that nowhere in the country can a minimum wage worker who's working full time afford to rent a modest two-bedroom apartment. Mm. And that's typically looked at, you know, are you paying more than 30%, right? More than about a third of your income every month for rent. And they found that that was the case even in places that have higher minimum wages, right? Like in some urban areas, places like Seattle, places like New York and Washington, D.C.
Based on your findings, what are some other recommendations for policy leaders in tackling poverty? I mentioned some of the Democratic candidates. Cory Booker is pushing for a $300 monthly cash allowance to families with young children. Will that really be enough to spur what you're talking about, which is really talking about overhauling change and providing and spurring economic opportunities for folks?
It's certainly a start. You know, one of the best things we can do to help families with young children or young children themselves move out of poverty is to increase the income to their families, right? I always say that if you care about children, you've got to care about their parents. And we've got good research that shows that, you know, an infusion of increased income, you know, in the range of $3,000 a year when children are young can actually have a pretty big impact on their later workforce earnings as adults. So it's one of the very best things we can do. And so while $300 a month doesn't seem like a lot of money perhaps, it's definitely a start and can make the, you know, big difference between, you know, a family being able to afford diapers, right? Other resources for their children, tutoring, access to extracurricular activities.
Nisha Patel serves as the managing director of Narrative Change and National Initiatives for Robinhood, a New York City-based nonprofit focused on fighting poverty. Thank you so much, Nisha, for joining us.
Thank you, Tanya.